Welcome to Stargraving Cinema, and a delight, a pleasure to be in the mind palace of Mr. Andy Nyman, actor, writer and director. Welcome to Stargraving Cinema, Andy.
Hello, it's very lovely to see you.
What's your very first pop culture memories growing up?
I think like a lot of my generation, born in 66, so grew up in the 70s. And it was a fantastically innocent, fruitful time, especially for all the things that I love. Movies, movie toys, comics, movie tie-ins. It just felt like we were really in the heart of a cultural shift where all the things that I've gone on to just adore, it's not like I have to look far for the roots of that. Because also, I mean, as you look around this room that we're in, it's filled with things from my childhood. You know, the same sort of monster toys, the same James Bond bits, the same bits of comics. And then, of course, great music. I mean, you know, I'm never happier than listening to music from the 70s. Really, and then up through to the 80s, you know, I was very big into ska and Two Tone. That was my real sort of teenage coming of age period. So I think they would be my big sort of cultural touch points.
What were your work and career aspirations when you was at school and college? You know, you get asked that boring question. Where do you see yourself? What would you like to do in the future?
I mean, literally doing exactly what I'm doing. I knew from a very early age I wanted to do something with English because I was lazy at school. And I knew that I kind of liked performing a bit. I was a bit of a show-off, but not like crazy. But the turning point was seeing Jaws at the pictures and seeing Richard Dreyfuss. And there I was, little curly-haired, stocky Jewish kid wearing glasses, and up on the screen in the most terrifying, exciting, brilliant film, one of the leads was this little curly-haired, stocky Jewish guy wearing glasses. I just thought, oh my good God, I can do this. You don't have to be Paul Newman or Robert Redford as it was. You don't have to look like a god, you know, to be in that world. And that was a massive thing for me. And actually something I've sort of taken forward, I think, really, in terms of sort of representation and diversity and things, I really see the importance of that, because when I see the impact that had on me, you know, I see the importance of how it can truly change the course of someone's life. So that was it. I'm doing exactly what I always wanted to do, and I do not take that for granted, let me tell you, Paul.
And how did you start out? What was your first job?
I got into drama school. I did drama at sixth form.
Would you recommend that to the audience, people go
to
drama school?
It really depends. I mean, the business has changed so much. I think, yeah, look, if you can get an apprenticeship and a training in anything, it's worth doing. So I left drama school aged 21, and I didn't work for 2 years, you know, so I was just really starting the actor's life, which is feast or famine, mainly famine, and you're grafting, you know, you're finding other ways to earn a living.
What was your first job?
Box office. I did a lot of box office work, actually at the Duke of York's, where we ended up doing Ghost Stories. So that was the most glorious.
So it's like coming home.
Full circle. But I can remember very clearly working in the box office when I'd left, and the actors who were in the show at the Duke of York's when I was there were all really fucking snooty and rude to the box office when they'd come and want tickets, or I just hated them for it. So I always learnt from that as well. So I'm always over nice, or try to be over nice, to, you know, because I know what it's like. So I did that, and then I was doing, drove vans and lorries for a while. I did all sorts of work, and then started selling the magic cards in Hamleys, Svengali cards. It's because I had a passing interest in magic at that point. I'd done it a bit when I was a kid. So I went and worked there doing that, and the magic just bit me. I became addicted to it, and also learnt a massive amount, because, you know, but at the end of that 8 months or year that I'd done in Hamleys, you know, you've worked 10,000 people or whatever it is, just day after day after day, doing the same trick again and again and again.
Wow.
And you just learn so much, you know, it's amazing. You learn so much about how to perform, about misdirection, about human nature.
It's sort of perfect training.
It's phenomenal. It was phenomenal. Yeah. It was for Marvin's Magic, selling the Svengali cards. And I very proudly can tell you that I hold the record for selling more Svengali cards in Hamleys than anyone else in the history of the shop, which I love. And in fact, if you ever go into Hamleys and see the demonstration from Marvin's Magic, that is my demonstration that they sort of always teach as the sort of benchmark thing to do. Yeah, I loved it.
Did you get a copyright on it, Andy?
No,
well?
Do I hell. But I'm so grateful to Marvin Burglass, who is Marvin's Magic, because, you know, it paid my rent for a year. Plus, I learnt so much and really got into that world. And also, beautifully, my son Preston, a few years ago, did some Deming for him, and we became the first second-generation Dem. Wow. You know, father then the son. So it was really special, yeah.
And what was your first either acting or magician gig?
Well, no, the magic was always just a hobby. That was always just a way. So I can tell you that what they both were. The magic has always been a way for me to pay my way. Although I realise now I do it at a very high level and it's been a creative force in my life. So the first magic gig I ever did was a close-up gig at a restaurant in the West End, and I was booked to do an hour and a half. And at that point, I was driving vans and lorries and cutting my hands on glass that I was delivering and all sorts of stuff. And I think I was getting, you know, we're talking about late 80s, and I was probably earning 120 quid a week. And I got this magic gig that I think was £110 for 2 hours, which was sort of the going rate then. And I just thought, oh my God, why am I driving lorries? I'll do this.
Yeah.
So that was my first close-up gig. And this was the first gig that I ever did. And I don't know if you remember at the time, there was the film The Grifters.
Yes.
With John Cusack, wasn't it? I think it was about con men.
Hmm.
So I called myself the Tabletop Grifter.
The Tabletop Grifter.
And I had these handmade cards that had this, again, I sound so old, it's crazy, but it wasn't, if you wanted a logo doing, it wasn't done on computer. This, you know, I got an artist to do this Grifters logo for me, and that was my business card. And there are still people to this day who call me the Tabletop Grifter. You know, either people that had booked me then or people from the magic world who were gigging with me at the time. So that's what I went out as. And that was my first job as a magician. My first acting job was at the Watford Palace. I did a Neil Simon play called The Gingerbread Lady with Sheila Stiefel. And it felt amazing to actually act and get paid for it.
Were you one of the key parts in that?
Small part, small memorable part. Good fun. But
does the Watford Palace still exist?
It does still exist. It's a very beautiful Frank Matcham Theatre.
Right.
Yeah, it's really a lovely theatre. My first telly job was The Woman in Black.
Fantastic.
The Herbie Wise seminal TV. That was my first ever telly job.
And which part did you play in The Woman in Black?
One of the clerks. Where it was me and Steve McIntosh. And Adrian Rawlings was the lead, and we were his two clerks. And it filmed at Shepperton. And I just remember being in a proper film set and hearing a film camera and seeing a clapperboard and hearing action and thinking, I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe that I am acting with film in a camera. Because it wasn't digital then. I mean, I sound ancient. It's ridiculous. I just happened to have crossed into a revolution. You know, the digital revolution happened halfway through my career. It's not like I'm 90. But it's funny, actually, all those things have changed. You know, the end of every shot, you'd hear checking the gate, you know, and they'd have to check to see if there's hair in the gate, if it can affect the film, or all that language is gone, really. But yeah, that was very, very special.
And tell us about your career journey. Has it been a difficult or an easy or just a natural progression from actor, writer, director?
Novelist.
Novelist, magician, etc.
I don't feel it's been easy, that's for sure. And I feel that, look, the life of an artist, and I don't mean that in a Ponzi, I am an artist, but trying to make your living in the arts is what I mean by that. Someone who makes their living in, for me, show business, but in the arts, is not easy. And it's not, that's not even, there are so many constraints within that. It's not even just the earning a living, which is uniquely difficult. It's the emotional side of it. It's your ego. It's having a massive hit that then leads to nothing. It's having no hits ever. It's trying to book a holiday with your family, knowing that you're going to get a job that will clash with the first 4 days of that 2 weeks and completely screw it up. It's not being able to go to weddings. It's not being able to commit to anything. So there are a zillion sacrifices and complications that go with it. But what I can see is that a lot of my sacrifices have paid off. I've made a living in show business for 40 years. That's no mean feat.
But can you pinpoint the moment when everything changed for you?
I don't feel it has, Paul. I don't feel it has. I'm not being humble. I don't feel it has. So the first lead I played in a film that was a huge thing for me emotionally was in Dead Babies. I guarantee none of your listeners will have seen that film.
Well, no one likes me. Actually, most people dislike me instinctively, including my family. Never had a girlfriend or a friend of any kind. I'm fat, poor, bald, horrible, spotty face, constipation, BO, bad breath, no prick, and I'm 1 inch tall. That's why I'm mad now. Fair enough.
It's me, Paul Bettany, Olivia Williams, Chris Marshall, Christian Solomino, great British cast. Of a Martin Amis movie. It was going to be the next Trainspotting. It was going to be huge. Took me 4 years to get the job with their finances and stuff. And the thing, you know, you make it vanish without a trace.
I had my really heavy recurring dream again last night, actually.
What happened?
It's the one where all my teeth fall out.
It's a sex dream when all your teeth fall out. Something to do with sexual failure.
No, it isn't. It's just about my teeth falling out.
Oh, I see.
Talk about a baptism of fire. I learned then that I cannot justify in my head, I cannot be validated by what other people think of me or my work. It can only be for me. I can only validate myself through me.
Yep.
So what was wonderful was playing a lead in a film, having grown up wanting to do that. But, you know, when you're making that film, you're being told, oh, my God, you're incredible in this. You're going to win. You'll win a BAFTA for this. It's amazing. You know, and you start listening to it and think, well, this will change my career. It doesn't. No, it doesn't at all. And that keeps going and keeps going. You know, leads in Channel 4 series, you know, leads in ITV series. And so for me, it's really an amalgam of just doing the best work you can, chipping away at it, always trying to be brave and just always hoping, you know, of course you live in hope. Of course you do. You know, when my agent rings me on my phone, the image that comes up is an Oscar. And has been for years, you know. And I love that dream because why not have that as my dream?
Absolutely. Ghost stories. How did that come about? That's a collaboration that you did with Jeremy Dyson.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Ghost Stories was a play that myself and Jeremy Dyson wrote in, I think, 2010 it came out, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was a scary play that was contemporary and was pitched to audiences almost like a horror film on stage. Became a smash hit, really. I mean, it ran in the West End for 13 months.
It's multiple venues.
Yeah, it's had three runs in the West End, so over 3 years in the West End. It's been all over the world. One of the big things we did was we kept the plot absolutely secret, and we continue to do that.
Amazing.
The only way you can find out what it's about is to go see it.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you dig on the internet, you'll find out. But don't. Why would you spoil it? Because there are great twists and turns. Jeremy and I met when we were 15 years old. We met at Jewish summer camp and became dear friends, Friends in Horror was the thing. You know, we were both reading Fangoria and Starburst and had all the same Alan Frank books. So it was that and sort of Dirty Jokes. You know, that was the thing that united us. Nothing's changed. We'd been talking for a while about, wouldn't it be fun to work together? And we're both married. He lives up north. I live down here. We're both married. We both have kids. We both have very busy marriages, lives, careers. So, as you know, you sort of talk to friends a lot and say, oh, we should do something together. Chances are you're never going to. It just doesn't work time-wise. Anyway, I'd been to see The Vagina Monologues, which I didn't really enjoy. It's a play, for those who don't know it, all about the vagina. It was a worldwide phenomenon, but it's basically three women on stage reading facts and stuff. But it's really sort of very empowering play about women. Very interesting, but I didn't really like it too much. And what that meant was I sort of sat there looking at this thing and thinking, this is one hell of a business model. This is three women, no set. They're sitting on stools. They're reading it. This thing's all over the world. That's a good business model. And that sort of sat in my mind. And about a week later, I was walking past The Woman in Black and thinking, this thing has been on for 20 years and there's never been another horror play during that time. That is mental. That's like not having another musical on because Phantom of the Opera's on. Doesn't make sense to me. So I called Jeremy and I said, I've had this idea for a play, which is The Vagina Monologues with ghost stories. Three men sitting on stools telling ghost stories. And I think that there's a play there. That is obviously not what Ghost Stories turned into, but that was the seed of the idea. And Jeremy really liked it. And I called him at exactly the right time. He'd finished another job. He was a little bit dissatisfied and looking for what could he do next to get back to that thing we dream of, which is pure creativity, where you can be untethered and just write from the place of joy. And then I went and did a play, and the play was wonderful fun. It was a thing called Moonlight and Magnolias. It was about David O. Selznick, about writing of Gone with the Wind. Very funny, very crowd-pleasing, moving play. And the director said to me afterwards, let's work together again. I've really enjoyed this. Whatever you want to do, I'll do. I said, well, me and Jeremy Dyson have got this idea, which is The Vagina Monologues with ghost stories. And he went, ooh, that's great. That's a great idea. As luck would have it, 2 months later, he becomes artistic director of the Lyric Hammersmith. And he phones me up, literally the second phone call he made, first day in the office, said, what's happening with that play? Well, we're talking about it and we think he's coming tomorrow. Let's have a chat. And we went in the next day and we'd formulated some rules, me and Jeremy, which were, it would be 90 minutes long.
Perfect.
Straight through, three men telling these stories, and it would be as scary as any modern horror film. That's what we were going to deliver for an audience. So he said, great, we'll do it. And we're going to open a year from now. And this is the date. We're putting it in the diary. And we thought, fuck, we've done it now. What are we going to do? Anyway, we then wrote the play. Thank God it worked. It was a big hit. We then ended up turning it into a movie, which we made with Warp Films. We were offered big money to do it in the States, which we did not want to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Professor Philip Goodman. I'm here today to share three apparently supernatural incidents with you, all of which seem deeply troubling.
It is so British, you know, the DNA of that.
You don't have to have your life ruled by superstitious fear.
Everything that made me and Jeremy as kids, all those things we loved, just infused into this film. So we wanted it to be British and we made it with Warp Films, who were amazing.
The brain sees what it wants to see. My job is to try and untangle the truth from the fiction.
At what stage did you think this has got legs to be a film?
As soon as we came up with the idea, we knew it was very cinematic.
Right.
Mr. Goodman, everything you have spent a lifetime trying to debunk the supernatural, it's all true. Three cases I couldn't explain. You go and investigate if you dare. Things are not always as they seem.
But we also knew we just want the play to be a play first. And then you've got a whole other challenge, which is one of the joys of the play was the chutzpah of seeing basically a horror film on stage, the tropes of a horror film on stage.
So I remember seeing it just on the road from here in Hammersmith, and it was the smells as
well.
There was actual
Yeah, there
which
were.
Which obviously you can't get in the film version.
Yeah.
You know, unless you do it as a scratch and sniff card in a John Waters kind of style.
That's also pure fairground. I mean, you know, that is absolutely Disney World. We're both huge theme park fans. And that sort of tickling all the senses was something we really wanted to do. So then we adapted it into a film, which, thank God, people absolutely love. And it did very well. And we're very proud of. So that's Ghost Stories.
I love looking through your CV or your IMDb CV. Yeah. But there does seem there's a genre bent to it. Chris Smith, for example, with Severance.
Yeah.
And Black Death, Dead Set as well.
I have thought about this a lot and thought, what is my niche? I do play a lot of different roles, but I think when I look at it, the thing that really excites me, I play a lot of extremes, characters that are extreme. And that can be extreme in an insular sense, extreme in a violent sense, extreme in an eager to please sense, you know. But I seem to live in that world a little bit. So that sometimes does sit very comfortably with horror or thrillers or broad comedy. But I love the fact that I have this unbelievably diverse career. But again, that's not been easy, because what that boils down to is, you know, the first 15 years of my career, they didn't know what the hell to do. You know, little Jewish guy. Well, you don't look English. What does that mean? I mean, it's so, honestly, it's tropes now that you just think, holy shit, the world has changed and needs to change. So I spent, you know, the beginning of my career was Greeks, Italians, you know, just because they don't know what to do with you.
What's been the biggest challenge to maintain the work you're involved with and keep projects both exciting and interesting for you?
It's finding the projects. That's the hard thing. And occasionally, you know, and when you do get those scripts that appear, then thinking, how do I secure being in this? Because this is the most brilliant script. So Dead Set's a great example of that. I hadn't done a telly for 10 years because I hadn't wanted to. And then my agent said, look, there's this script. It was called Balloon Wars, was the working. You know, they often give weird titles to things they don't know.
Because obviously they're keeping it under wraps.
And she said, it's telly. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to do. And she said, it's written by Charlie Brooker. I was like, whoa, hang on a minute. That I want to see.
And how would you describe Dead Set?
I think it's amazing, Dead Set. It's set in the Big Brother house. So it looked and felt exactly like Big Brother. You had Davina in it. I mean, it really, truly felt like the real deal.
Grayson, Marky and Pippa.
Someone's coming up!
37 minutes to go, minions.
Take Ashley into the BBLV room.
Yeah, I'm on it.
So you've got these people isolated in the Big Brother house, unaware of the fact that a zombie apocalypse has broken out in the world outside.
It's not really real, is it?
This is Big Brother.
Eyewitnesses describe dead or injured people attacking one another.
Stop breathing!
Something is wrong!
Does this mean we're not on telly anymore?
This is Davina. You have 30 seconds to say your goodbyes. I'm coming to get you!
Dead Set. Coming soon.
And it was the first thing Charlie, the first drama Charlie had written.
This is pre-Black Mirror.
Pre-Black Mirror.
Yeah.
And it was really, really amazing to read this new voice, you know, this acerbic, brilliant voice. And, oh my God, I was over the moon to get that job.
It was an incredible, incredible piece. So, the book, The Warlock Effect.
Yes.
Available now in all good booksellers.
Yeah.
How did this come about? This is another project with Jeremy Dyson.
Jeremy Dyson, yes. So this is our first novel, which has had wonderful reviews. Sunday Times Thriller of the Month. I mean, it's really, we're very excited by it. It was originally a film idea that had been kicking around with us for a while. We've been talking about the idea of a British magician in Soho in the 1950s getting embroiled with espionage. And we'd worked up about a first third of a film. And then just before lockdown, Jeremy got a call from a lady who'd been a producer on comedy that Jeremy Dyson, my oldest friend who I wrote Ghost Stories with, is the fourth member of the League of Gentlemen, for the people who don't know. And he'd received a call from a woman called Mifanwy Moore, who had moved from comedy to Hodder Publishing House. And she just reached out to Jeremy and said, look, we're looking for, I know you're into magic, and We're looking for novels that might have a magician as a recurring character. Is there anything that you or Andy are working on that you think might suit? And Jeremy said, as a matter of fact, there is. And then he came to me and said, look, I think we could do the Warlock effect as a novel instead. Well, look, I have imposter syndrome at the best of times. The idea of writing a novel is acute because I'm not terribly literary. I'm not a huge reader. So it's one thing directing a movie I had no imposter syndrome with whatsoever. I've seen 20 million films and I know as long as you're surrounding yourself with a great team, how bad can it go? And the thing that I always say to Jeremy, I said it with the play, I've said it when we made the film, the worst that happens is you make a shit movie. There's plenty of those. It's fine. No matter, it could win 15 Oscars. It's going to end up in the bargain bucket no matter what. It doesn't matter. It's fine.
In the pound shop.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same with the play. Anyway, it sort of brought out my worst, oh my God, can't write a novel. And we sat and we talked about it. And Jeremy was brilliant about, look, it's fine. It's just an extension of what we do with the play. We'll plot together. We'll work through it together. We'll write bits. We'll divvy it up. You'll send them to me. I'll send them to you. And we'll find a way through it. So I just thought, why not? Why not? So we said yes. And shortly after that, the lockdowns came. And it was a lifesaver, Paul. Because what I really, really, really learned about myself in the lockdown, I've just got to create. It's an essential part of who I am. And it was a joyous experience to write this novel together. And it's a spy novel, a love story. It's scary in places. It's really this wonderful hybrid. And people seem to love it, which is very exciting. And we are turning it into a TV series as well.
Was that always the plan?
Well, sort of a soft plan. You've always got to create something that you love. We don't create cynically as a sort of product, but equally, we've got very commercial heads. We knew when we were writing it that we would love to read this book and we would love to see this. So, you know, you're then in a wonderful place where you feel, if you feel that sincerely, I'm sure other people will. And sure enough, you know, there were a lot of film and TV companies who wanted to make it.
So this is going to be a TV series?
Yeah.
Will you be in it? Will you want to direct it?
Whether we direct all of it, I don't know, because that's a whole new learning curve. The idea of writing and directing 6 episodes of something is huge. Will I be in it? Quite possibly.
Do you have a character?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's a given.
Yeah.
Sequels. Do you have any? Do you have ideas?
It was a 2-book deal.
Aha. Okay.
But we know. We think we know what 3 books would be.
Okay. Fantastic.
Yes. If anyone out there who's listening to this hasn't read it yet, it is full of twists. If you like twists, you're in for a ball.
Fantastic. Aside from the Warlock effect, what other projects are you working on currently?
Yeah, writing our next... Well, we'll have to write the next book and the TV series, and we've got to finish our next play. Anyway.
Apart from that,
plus
not
whatever
much going
acting
on.
I'm doing, yeah.
What would you like to go on to achieve personally?
Continue having a happy life. Continue doing work that fulfills that, but above and beyond everything, continue sharing my life with my fantastic wife and kids and trying to create work that not only makes me proud and them proud, but makes people happy, that makes people excited and passionate and want to come back for more. And that's what you want. That's what you dream of with your work. It's unbelievably special. And it's a blessing to be able to do that.
What would you say is the worst or the funniest job that you've ever had?
The worst was a weird training day as an actor. There were like 3 or 4 of us. And we had to do this god-awful song that had been written for us on the day. I mean, awful, awful, awful. And I was so nervous on the day that I got this massive allergic...
massive what?
Allergic reaction. Oh, so like my lips swelled up so badly. And we had to kiss. Me and a bloke had to kiss. He was a mate. And he'd sort of put that in on the day he'd written it. I was so anxious and nervous that my fucking lips exploded. So that was probably the worst
So can you remember the song?
No, I can't.
It's too painful to recall.
Yeah, too painful. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I'll be back to discover our guest's pop culture picks after this message. On June the 4th, Severin Films goes goth like never before. Dance Macabre Volume 3 features four restored classics of Spanish gothic horror, all scanned from their negatives with over 8 collective hours of special features. Necrophagus is a worldwide Blu-ray premiere, now restored, fully uncut. The four-part anthology, Cake of Blood, is available for the first time outside of Spain. Cross of the Devil from Hammer director John Gilling gets its first ever home video release in English. And Leon Klimovsky's vampire classic, The Night of the Walking Dead, can be experienced like never before in an all-new 2K scan. Purchase Dance Macabre Volume 3 from the Severin web store and get 50% off Dance Macabre's Volume 1 and Volume 2. On June the 4th, Dance Macabre Volume 3 delivers Spanish gothic horror at its very best, only from the fine folks at Severin Films. Now back to Stark Raving Cinema.
Andy, what was the film or TV show that changed your life? And what was it about it that got under your skin or moved you?
Okay, well, Jaws obviously changed my life in so much that it cemented me wanting to be an actor. But the movie that properly changed my life was Deep Red, was Profundo Rosso, the Dario Argento horror giallo thriller.
You have killed him. And you will kill again.
You're getting closer and closer to the most unnatural kind of death, Deep Red.
Where did you see that?
So, I saw that our local video club had a copy of it, and it was just around the Video Nasty time. And I'd gone from hating horror. I was very, very scared of horror. In fact, The Fog really changed that. That was the first one I went to see at the cinema. My sister said, oh, let's go see it. It's a double A. It won't be scary. It's fine. Because I thought, well, X has to be scary.
Something is moving in the fog.
Who's there?
Something not quite human.
Who is that?
The Fog. A study in unrelenting terror.
Boy, was I wrong. I mean, that film, you know, was a roller coaster ride. I often think of that as my sort of horror bar mitzvah. I went into that film as a boy, came out a man. I was 14. I absolutely loved it. I still love that movie. So that really was a gear shift for me. I then thought, oh my God, who is this guy, John Carpenter? And around that time, Halloween was shown on telly.
In Halloween, John Carpenter created a night of absolute fear.
So I videoed it, and I must have watched Halloween 20 times. I just couldn't believe how brilliant and scary it was and how wonderful the music was. Then video clubs happened, VHS, the revolution happened. And suddenly, the gloves were off. You were seeing world cinema in a way you'd never seen it. Directors that you'd never heard, certainly I had never heard of, that I knew nothing about. And, you know, these fantastic, ludicrous, lurid video covers to tempt you with their tits and blood and gore and zombies. And
often the films didn't actually deliver.
Nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with the covers.
Well, it said on the tin.
As long as they'd got the rental, that's all that matters. But I remember seeing this cover that was David Hemmings looking through, it was a hole in a wall and he had a torch and there was a skeleton, like an embalmed body. And it was a really strong image. Dario Argento's Deep Red. And there was a sticker that wasn't a sticker. It was part of the design that said, caution, contains extreme bloody violence. And I thought, I'm having that. I'm renting that.
Deep Red. It'll put you into deep shock.
And I was expecting, and this was one of the joys, the overlooked joys of that period, was there was so much shit that you sat through. But what was also within all of that were these remarkable movies that had been like hits in their home territories, you know, and were proper films, brilliant films. And I loved Once Upon a Time in the West. I'd seen that and loved it and didn't realise that Dario Argento, who wrote and directed Deep Red that I was about to watch, had written the giallo sequence in Once Upon a Time in the West, all the hanging stuff that you're given in these jigsaw pieces that comes together at the end. So I had no idea. I was expecting this bloody, stupid, ridiculous horror film. In Deep Red, I mean, it is ultra violent, but it is the most brilliantly made, incredible thriller. And the music, the Goblin soundtrack, the look of it, I had never seen anything like it.
What is it?
Didn't you hear that?
There's somebody in the house, absolutely trying to kill me. If you hadn't stuck your damn nose in it all.
And actually, there you go, this is how much it changed me. The music at the beginning of the play of Ghost Stories that explodes over the audience is the Goblin theme to Deep Red. It was a rubber stamp moment for me. So that was really the film that properly changed
your
me.
Your mind expanded.
Properly mind expanding.
What was the very first film that you remember seeing at the cinema and specific memories of it? And also, which cinema?
Good question. Well, it would have been one of two cinemas. There were two cinemas in Leicester that were the big cinemas. There was the Odeon and the ABC. The Odeon, my dad was an NHS dentist, and the manager of the Odeon was a guy called Lou, who was a patient of my dad's. So if ever we went to the Odeon...
Free tickets.
It was a bit of free tickets, free popcorn.
Nice.
I mean, and again, this Odeon that's no longer there, the building is still there. Magnificent Art Deco picture palace, glorious staircase leading up to this big screen. So many happy memories there and at the ABC. The ABC was where I saw The Fog. I can't honestly remember what the very first film I saw was. I remember very clearly us going in the way that you would back then when that, you know, the Disney films would all get re-released. So you'd be going off to see Mary Poppins would be
or
released.
Jungle Book.
Jungle Book, yeah. You know, because that was the only way to see them. They weren't released on, well, there weren't videos then, you know. So that was always an event. But my parents had a real love of cinema and theatre, which I absolutely absorbed from them. I can't give you a specific... That was the first film I ever saw. I can remember seminal films, but just the experience of going to the cinema remains an absolute joy. The audiences are less joyful now than when they were. The amount of people on their phones, the amount of people chatting, the stink of food. I mean, I know I sound old, but it drives you mad.
Exactly.
But, my God, the cinema, bliss.
Do you have a favourite actor?
I mean, I grew up obsessed with De Niro. De Niro and Pacino were the guys. That was what my idea of acting was, and still is, if I'm honest. I'm very proud of the fact I don't really get recognised. And I'm including in that people will see me in a movie and tell me about movies that I'm in. And they'll be like, oh, my God, have you seen Judy? I'm like, yeah, yeah. Oh, there's this brilliant bit in it, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know, that's me. What? No, it's not. Yeah, it is. Is it? You know, I love that because that's
perfect
what
chameleon.
Well, that's what I love. That's what I grew up wanting to emulate was watching these men lose themselves in roles and who they were became invisible and they sort of shapeshifted. And that's something that I've always tried to do. I really love that. So they were the guys for me, De Niro and Pacino.
Is there a film you think everybody should seek out? It can be very obscure. And can you introduce it to our audience as if you were on stage?
Well, one of them is, of course, Deep Red.
Sure.
And you do definitely need a bit of a strong stomach to watch it. A, because it's violent. B, because some of the acting and dubbing ain't great. The other one, arrogantly, that I can't not say, is Ghost Stories, the film of Ghost Stories, because it's one of the proudest achievements of my life. Me and Jeremy love the film and love the fact we've made a film. We made a film.
It exists. You know, it's in shop.
It's mind-blowing. The BBC have shown it like four times. It was on Christmas Eve last year.
Do you rewatch it when it's on TV?
Not
always. Or do
always.
You dip into it? Just happenstance.
What? I'll record it because almost the best bit is strap yourselves in on BBC Two for a night of horror. Coming up now, Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson's seminal horror film, Ghost Stories. Viewers should be warned, or whatever they say. But that, because you grew up on that. An announcer telling me, oh, what's this film going to be? It's not even like I'm being arrogant. I'm not saying to you, watch Ghost Stories. I think it's probably the best film ever made. I'm not saying that. I want as many people as possible to see our film because we made a film and it's a good film. You might not love it, but it's good. And we made it.
Would you ever do a sequel?
No, not a sequel. Absolutely not.
A prequel?
No. Because the thing was, they wanted, there was talk of that, but we're purists. And you'd bastardised the truth of the world you've set up. So fortunately, because we made it with a little British independent, there weren't like monstrous American companies bullying you into taking it off your hands and making Ghost Stories 2, where you're just watching your world that you've created just get ripped to pieces. Yeah. So no, a sequel doesn't really appeal.
Who was the first either artist or live band that you went to see?
We did go to concerts with my folk, you know, as a family. We'd go and see every now and then at the De Montfort Hall in Leicester, we'd go and see the Halle Orchestra and the 1812 Overture, where they'd have a proper canon on stage for the big bit at the end. But I was big into two-tone, and that really hit as I became in my sort of mid to late teens. The first band I ever saw live was The Specials.
Wow, amazing.
I saw The Specials, Body Snatchers, Madness, Secret Affair, fantastic stuff.
And what do you remember from the first, from The Specials concert?
Absolutely thrilling / scary. I mean, the worst fight I ever saw was Outside the Beat concert. Skinhead girls and punk girls kicking the shit out of each other. I mean, it absolutely kicked off. But The Specials, they were absolutely brilliant. I was really sad when Terry Hall died recently, and he was a brilliant songwriter, let alone just how electrifying the music was. Even though it had this sort of slightly skimming off punk, this sort of violence about it, it was just all about black and white being as one, tearing down those walls, equality. So the gigs were really exciting. I loved it. I can't imagine going to a concert now.
Your favourite LP of all time? Your favourite album?
Very obscure. It's a Jack Jones album called Harbour that was something that we used to listen to as a family a lot, that my dad used to play in the car. I absolutely adore it. Jack Jones was a sort of easy listening singer.
From the, was it 50s and 60s?
Yeah, through to sort of 70s, 80s as well.
And what were the big tracks?
No big tracks. You wouldn't know any of them. None of them were hits. I still listen to that at least once a week. I absolutely adore it.
And do you have it as a physical vinyl
album? I do have it as a physical vinyl, but I listen to it. It's on my phone. So that would be my favourite vinyl LP.
Yeah.
Paul Williams wrote a few of the songs. You know, Paul Williams from Phantom of Paradise
Brilliant composer.
Muppets and Bugsy Malone. Yeah. Okay. I did a movie called Death at a Funeral that Frank Oz directed, and Frank and I became great friends. He directed me in a play which was a disaster, not because of Frank. Anyway, Paul Williams was in London, and Paul came to the play because of Frank. So I met Paul Williams, and I told him, I said, oh my God, there's two tracks on this album that you wrote that I adore. He has no memory of this album whatsoever. No memory of the songs he'd written. But he did say to me, that's so nice to hear. Should we phone Jack and tell him? I was like, fuck off. So we called Jack Jones, who wasn't in.
Oh.
And I left a message, this insane message saying, Jack, I can't believe I'm leaving a message on your answer phone. I'm here with Paul Williams. Your album Harbour means the world. Yeah. So I did actually vicariously get to leave a message on Jack Jones's answer phone.
Amazing. Is there a record or a track that you think everybody should hear that you're either listening to now or an obscurity that you'd like to recommend to the audience?
I know what I'm going to recommend. It's a track called Splanky, Count Basie. You want to try and listen to the live version of it. Oh, my good God. It's phenomenal. The energy of it. I love jazz. Oh, it's truly fantastic. So that would be my one recommendation to listen to.
So, Andy, do you have a favourite book at all?
My favourite book wouldn't be a novel or anything like that, but I'm very, very visual. And there's a book that I came across called Mail Order Mysteries, and it's by a guy called Kirk Demaray. And basically, he had very similar interests to me in terms of magic and comics growing up and stuff. And this book, you know those ads you'd get in the comics? Mm. All the little small ads for sort of...
X-ray specs or seahorses or...
Sea monkeys. Learn kung fu, learn to kill, you know, all this.
Yeah.
You know,
Charles Atlas.
Exactly, Charles Atlas. Buy the 9-foot Frankenstein.
Yes.
This book, he bought every single one of them. So the book is, here's the advert, here's what I expected it to be, here's what it is.
That's amazing.
And it's witty and funny, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book.
So, the film you are saving for a first watch, that you know you're going to love, but you're waiting either the right time, either with the right people, or the right environment,
or
the right cinema.
I'll tell you what I've never seen. That Jeremy, when he hears this, is going to be, you what? Because it's his favourite film. 2001.
Wow.
Never seen it.
That must be because you're waiting for the right time.
It isn't.
Time.
I'm not...
And it's a commitment. That's quite a long film. Yeah.
And I'm not a massive sci-fi fan.
Right.
So I always feel like I'll be, I think it'll be an amazing achievement, but it's what I'll think of it as a film. So that's when I need to watch. That is a proper hole that I think I probably bluff whenever Jeremy, I'm like, yeah, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, it's great. I love that bit. I've never seen it. So there you
go. Incredible.
Yeah, so I need to watch that.
What do you think is the most influential film or TV or music on your career specifically?
I think that's quite a hard question to answer. Because I think what I've learned about myself is how much stuff goes in by osmosis. Yeah. And then when you're creating, you suddenly realise, wow, I had no idea that had such an impact on me. I can't pin it down to one thing, but, you know, this room that we're sitting in, it's a bit like, I always think it's like sitting in my brain. I'm surrounded by things that have influenced my taste, everything that's in my work that I create with Jeremy or create with Darren or create on my own. And that includes acting. You know, it's all of these influences.
Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for inviting us into your mind palace. It's been a fascinating place.
Oh, well, I've loved it. I've loved talking to you. Thank you for asking me.
Stark Raving Cinema was presented by Paul McAvoy, produced and edited by Jake West, with original music by Simon Boswell, graphic design by Ashley Thorpe, and our digital content director is Aaron Truss. Our episodes drop every 2 weeks. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe.
When Rose woke up in her favourite shop doorway, she was resigned to yet another day of hunger, struggle, and abuse. This was her life on the streets, after all. What she wasn't prepared for
was a visit from a demon. An invitation back to his temporarily insubstantial sanctuary. Being forced to take sides in a battle involving most of the denizens of hell.
Oh, and a boat trip down the River Thames. Gape, a novel by Aidan Truss, available exclusively on Amazon.